Shrink Wrap Radio number 371, an exploration of parent-teen relationships with Dr. Michael O'Connor.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Michael O'Connor, and we'll be discussing his work with troubled teens. Michael O'Connor, MD, is the program medical director for the Adolescent Psychiatric Unit at Kelowna General Hospital in British Columbia. Dr. O'Connor also consults to youth in crisis at Kelowna General Hospital in the emergency room, the pediatric ward, and sees youth in crisis through an urgent response program to prevent hospital admissions. In addition, he consults to an outpatient eating disorder program for patients of all ages and has a small private practice. Dr. O'Connor completed medical school at the University of Ottawa in 1997 after completing an undergraduate degree in psychology. He went on to complete his psychiatric residency program at the University of Toronto, specializing in children and adolescents. During his residency, Dr. O'Connor pursued specialized training in neuropsychiatry, publishing a paper on mild head injury, in addition to pursuing psychotherapy training in interpersonal psychotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy, and psychodynamic approaches. In addition to his clinical and administrative work, he's been providing education to the public and to mental health practitioners through the Canadian Medical Health Association. And some of his talks are available online on topics from eating disorders in youth to adolescent depression and suicide. You can find some of those on Vimeo, and you'll also probably find links on his blog, which you'll find at teenshrink.blogspot.ca. Dr. O'Connor has special interests in attachment theory, culture, and neurodevelopment, and over the past 2 years has published an online blog titled Teen Shrink Talk, where he explores and reviews issues in neurodevelopment, culture, attachment, and mental health as they evolve through the lifespan. Dr. O'Connor has recently begun training in the modality of somatic experiencing, a therapeutic approach pioneered by Peter A. Levine, and is scheduled to become fully accredited by the fall of next year. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Michael O'Connor, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's a great pleasure.
Well, it's a real pleasure for me because you and I have had a lot of communication back and forth. You are a faithful Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and I feel like we're friends. And if we lived closer, that we would, in fact, be friends and hang out.
that's great, David. I feel the same way. I've enjoyed listening to your show tremendously. So it's a great privilege here to be able to talk to you like this.
Yeah, well, likewise. Now, I know that that the focus of your work as a psychiatrist is that you work with troubled teens in an inpatient setting. What drew you to specializing in working with teens?
That's an interesting journey for me. I mean, I went to psychiatry, which, as you know, goes, is a specialty select out of medical school. And that journey was one I was actually quite interested in a number of things, including neurology, but found psychiatry to be something that really appealed to me. And when you're working in medicine, you have to go a little bit against the grain, in a way. It's sometimes called the ugly stepchild of medicine, psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And so you had to kind of go against the grain a little to go there. But it really drew me. I found it fascinating and so much more interesting and rewarding for myself. So I found myself in psychiatry. And then within psychiatry, it's again another process of selecting where you're going to end up. And I somehow always got drawn to the most complicated thing. I found working with children and families it just intrigued me, and I found it so kind of, you know, like, I wanted to learn more because it was difficult to understand, and it was more complicated, and so I always found myself in kind of the most complicated areas. So I ended up here and working with adolescents and families. That's what I do, I enjoy it a lot.
Well, that's a good reason. I'm glad you shared that background with us, and that's sort of part of the focus that I want to have in our interview today is, you know, just how do you communicate with teens, how do parents, how do psychotherapists, and so on, and we'll be getting into that. But, of course, I have to wonder what were your own teen years like and whether or not that might have had something to do with your career choice.
Well, that's a great question, David, and I've heard you explore that here on your show with others. And my teen years were interesting. My parents are immigrants from Europe, and I was born in Canada. All my extended family remained in Europe, almost all. They kind of came to Canada in those really, you know, complicated years that followed World War II.
From where?
From Spain and Germany. My father was from Spain, so I have a broad family, based still back there in southern Spain, Andalusia area. And my mother from Germany. So I have extended family there in Germany. So they got together somehow. A little bit of a cultural, interesting. Yeah, coming together. And so I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a pretty big city up here in Canada. It's the biggest city in Canada. I found it kind of alienating in a way. I mean, it was interestingly, my parents ended up in a neighborhood that was culturally really quite different. It was interestingly a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood. It became a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood. So it wasn't really when they moved there. So I was very surrounded by a very different culture, as you can imagine.
Wow. Yes.
So it was complicated. I found it hard to kind of find a place. I did in the end, it became a bit of a tumultuous experience for myself, going through phases of probably a little bit too much alcohol use and things like that. But somehow managed to stay afloat, and I have had my own adjustments, which came a lot more during my early adulthood where I found myself having to get, psychiatric help for a period of time. And came through that. It was a, kind of powerful experience for me, very meaningful and very complicated, but managed to keep my ship afloat, get through medical school, and here I am.
Well, did your experience with psychiatry at that time impact your subsequent choice to go into psychiatry? It sounds like it was positive for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure my experience with psychiatry was positive, but the whole experience was, powerful and meaningful to me. So it certainly held a fascination, kind of makes you curious about that area and want to know more. And, you kind of lead you on if you think about it, you want to kind of understand your own experience. So, it's fascinating. So yes, certainly drew me there, and I guess I got through it in a way that I was curious and I wasn't I wasn't afraid of it.
Okay.
Certainly, yeah.
Now I understand that you're currently in charge of an adolescent psychiatric unit. So tell us a bit about that.
Great. So I'm here in British Columbia, Canada, and kind of moderate-sized city, about 200,000 kind of population. And there's a hospital here that I connected with. There was a few other child and adolescent psychiatrists when I arrived here. Right out of training, I did my training in Toronto. So I got here and I started up my practice. But they were developing an adolescent psychiatric unit here at the hospital. And so they kind of asked me if I wanted to take part in that. And I was quite interested to do so, and we started this unit up, an 8-bed unit to serve the area here, and we really wanted to try something a bit different from the traditional psychiatry kind of model. And so from the get-go, we started with a different approach to working with young people. I don't know if you've heard of Ross Green, Dr. Ross Green. He's a psychologist in the United States who wrote a number of books on working with children with difficult. He had a book, famous book called The Explosive Child, which always makes people think that the child was actually blowing up somehow like a bomb. But
I had not heard of him or that book, but The Explosive Child certainly reminds me of. And I'm going to forget a lot of things, but when I was in graduate school, I worked at a place called the Fresh Air Camp for emotionally disturbed boys. And so we had a lot of explosive kids there.
so you know what it means.
Resonates.
So exactly. So his work there, I mean, when I remember going through my training, I came across it in a number of settings, which, I mean, it was interesting because it really contradicted the other main approach that people were often being, you know, kind of directed towards. You might have heard, you know, 1-2-3 magic or the timeout, you know, all that kind of thing.
I haven't heard of 1-2-3 magic, but I certainly have heard of timeout.
Right. And so that's a very different, because I remember, you know, going through my training, I would, you know, they'd say, you know, here, watch this video, 1-2-3 magic. This is how we, you know, this is kind of how we direct parents to kind of, you know, work with their children and help them, you know, with discipline. So this is the approach. It's very behavioral.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was guessing. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's all about rewards and punishments, and comes from that entire, you know, I mean, area of psychology and of mental health, the practice of behavioralism, right?
Sure.
And so many psychiatric units kind of have that as their guiding principle of, you know, what they call milieu or, you know, kind of behavioral control or management or whatever you want to call it,
right,
where kids earn rewards or receive punishment, more or less, or lose privileges. Is, you know, if you want, you probably heard about the privilege system, you know?
Sure.
That's very often the kind of, so we wanted, because I'd done some research in the literature on avoiding seclusion and restraint in hospital, because as you know, it's one of the most traumatizing things that can happen to anyone when they end up in the hospital. It happened to me when I was in the hospital, where you end up, you know, being restrained and secluded. Very, very stressful experience. And so what they found is that one of the prime triggers for that kind of situation to unfold with young people in the hospital is if they have their privileges removed or if they have some kind of a, you know, kind of behavioral consequence dished out. And then it often starts the whole cascade going to that.
I understand that this approach that was developed by Ross Green, who you mentioned, is called collaborative problem solving, and that you've implemented
exactly.
That?
Exactly. It's called the collaborative problem solving method, and he's you know, he's kind of advanced that in his work, and he consulted to our program, and so basically kind of throws this whole system of behavioral interventions out. And it uses a very different approach on working with the young people that really involves a lot more engagement and problem solving, right?
Yeah.
It's a very problem solving based method, which first of all requires quite a lot more effort. So on the part of staff,
right,
it's a lot more complicated than just simply saying, "Oh, you did something wrong, consequence; you did something right, privilege," right? You know, and that's simpler. It takes less communication on the part of everybody communicating with one another. But this system, you know, we had a lot of really interest, a lot of good interest from our staff about wanting to work with this method. And, you know, we've had a lot of success with it. It's, you know, our rates of seclusion in our hospital, you know, it's almost never happened. So, you know, occasionally there's times where, you know, something gets very unsafe, and you know, you still have to do something like that because we're dealing with, you know, people who can be very ill, but it's very infrequent. So it's been really rewarding that way. Yeah, and it's helped me to kind of understand that communication, and especially, you know, parenting, you know, has, you have to, you're working with these kind of trade-offs in a way of how we engage with one another, and the more we can work at engaging collaboration. It actually works with an entire different part of our nervous system and our brain, when we engage collaboratively, as opposed when we engage with one another reactively.
Okay, well, I'm going to want to go into that brain part of it a bit down the road. But before we go there, maybe you could give us an example or two, you know, a case examples from your experience of where this collaborative approach, as you say, is very challenging and yet effective.
Okay, sure, So try and think of a good example here. So, you know, this is a case. I'm going to kind of see if I can create a case here in my mind of a young person who, for example, we have school on our unit. And, you know, we do really make an effort to engage young people to take part in the school. So whereas, you know, perhaps in the traditional method, you might say, you know, if you are able to attend school, you'll be able to kind of advance your privilege level, perhaps, or something to that effect. You know, you'll have some certain privileges that you wouldn't have if you weren't attending school. That's very common, you know, and if you don't go to school, then those privileges get removed. So then what happens is, you know, there's some young people who won't go to school. And if you kind of use that system, you never really get to figure out why they wouldn't go to school. Whereas with a collaborative problem-solving strategy, you always start off with a curiosity, which is to say, hey, you know, what's up? And tell me about what might be making it hard to go to school. Where, you know, is it? And then you start this process of, you know, let's work together to try and figure out what's going on here. And then maybe we can find out a way that we could kind of create a way you could be in school that would work, you know, and find out what the barriers might be. I mean, you wouldn't be using this language with a young person, but in your mind, you're thinking, what are the barriers for this young person being in school? Is it perhaps he finds this teacher intimidating? Is it perhaps that the other kids make him nervous? Is it perhaps he's afraid of failing on the schoolwork? And you're asking, inviting and engaging in collaborative questions about, hey, you know, what is it that's really, you know, making you most nervous about being in this school? And, you know, the young person often does not know. But in the process of engaging them collaboratively, you open up their mind that gets curious about, is it this? No, I don't think that. Yeah, that seems more like it, you know. And then you might invite, hey, you know, what if we tried this out? You know, maybe being in a quiet part of the classroom, or maybe starting off by getting to know some of the other kids outside the classroom. You know, you can start being creative, and you can maybe create a little opportunity where they would do something that they, right away, they just sort of said no. But young people very often are not expecting you to do this. They expect you to be frustrated with them. They expect you to start coming down with, you know, you got to go to school, right? Or so to tell them, you know, all the bad things are going to happen if they don't go to school. So they're really surprised very often, and it depends a little on their background, when you engage that system. And then you start to figure out, and then you can find out more about what is actually going on with this young person that might be getting in the way. Whereas before you wouldn't have that information. So it helps you learn more about that. You know, it's an assessment tool from our point of view, but it also allows a new kind of development to happen that might not otherwise.
Well, let me just comment that I think curiosity is a very powerful concept. Interesting that curiosity plays such an important role there. It certainly flies in the face of thinking of oneself as a therapist, as a psychiatrist, as the expert, as the person who has all the answers and comes in with that kind of an attitude. And my own experience with curiosity is, one, I have some background in market research, as listeners may know. And the guy who trained me in that really emphasized the importance of curiosity, of when you're working for a company, a client, and they're trying to find out something about people's attitudes towards a product or a service, to really be curious about everything around that. And I think that training and that orientation really has also informed my approach to interviewing on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Right.
And then the other thing that I would note is a therapist that worked with me for a while. Her most outstanding characteristic, I would say, was her curiosity. And I think what curiosity ends up being is sort of a highly amped up interest in me. She just seemed so interested in every little detail of my life and of my thoughts and so on. And I realized, and she was greatly loved by many, many clients. And I think that just that level of attention to detail and curiosity communicates a deep level of caring.
And acceptance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's sort of an acceptance that, you know, this kind of would be okay, right? It would be okay if you were finding this difficult or that difficult. So all of a sudden, it sort of turns on a sort of a different pathway and energy in the relationship, which can be quite stabilizing and lead to positive change.
Is there anything in this approach that might be useful to parents with troubled adolescents living at home?
Yes, absolutely. You know, kind of because many parents didn't experience this kind of a engagement in their own upbringing. And also in any or in any other intervention or in any of the advice that they're given by, you know, people who kind of give parenting advice. I remember just being very struck by, wow, this is completely different than this other 1, 2, 3 magic thing. I mean, you know, there isn't it was all about clarity, which is important too. It has its time and place, but, and so that's the advantage. You know, you can be super clear in certain situations, maybe, right? Rather than, it's maybe also a bit of how do we, you know, conserve energy? We don't always have all the energy to manage every single situation this way. But for parents who, you know, have the resources to start this kind of a process up, it can really, really make an amazing difference in their relationship with their youngster who's having problems. Because all of a sudden, they become partners in overcoming these problems rather than adversaries in, like, you know, you screwed up again. You know, and you get into this negative cycle of, you know, groundings or you know whatever it is, right? You lose this, you lose that. Next thing you know, there's nothing left. You know, everything's being removed, and now they're really in a pit, and the parents are like, now what do we do? We've lost everything, you know, like we have no more leverage, right? Mm. Yeah.
Now, you're a parent yourself, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, remind me how many and what ages?
Okay, two youngsters. I got an 11-year-old, just turning 11, boy, and a girl who's going to be 9 in December, so... They're just starting to kind of peek around the corner at adolescence, well, at least the older one.
Yeah, right. So you'll really get a chance to put some of these ideas to the test.
Absolutely.
With your own kids. Yeah, and I'm sure you're laying the groundwork, you know, that will, you know, make it easier when you get there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you mentioned Ross Greene's book, The Explosive Child. I don't know if that's sort of a general purpose book for parents, or is there some other book that he's written that would be good for, you know, your average parent versus ones who are really in deep water?
I think, you know, really the principles in that book, and I mean, he's written some more recent books on collaborative problem solving, which I don't have the titles of offhand here, but if you kind of look them up, and I know he also does some things online for helping parents, even courses and things like this. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of good resources there to help people get the idea of how this might work. It's got this really neat advantage that it doesn't. See, very often people get the idea has to happen somehow, is that we either have to, you know, kind of engage with our kids and, you know, love them and be really receptive and accepting, right? In which case, all of a sudden, it sort of starts to sound like you can't have any expectations, like anything goes. It starts to feel that way, right? A lot of people are like, well, if I give up the grounding, I'm going to lose control here, right? I'm going to lose power. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. They're going to be all wishy-washy. And so the really neat thing about the collaborative problem-solving approach is that it doesn't lose that. We have expectations. You don't drop them. You just approach them differently. Uh-huh. So it's really nice because, you know, first of all, it takes a little thinking, well, how does that work? You know, how do you have expectations without these kind of punitive consequences or, you know, rewards, you know, like the stickers and the allowance, you know, if you do this, you get your allowance, if you do this, you don't get your allowance. But what we've learned and there's some research, that I've kind of across is that when you apply rewards, you often lose the natural incentives because there are natural incentives to most things.
Yes.
Helping out at home, you know, doing your homework. Doing all the things. There's natural rewards. And when you apply artificial rewards, like I'm going to pay you your allowance based on, you know, how many dishes you wash, that it takes away the natural incentive system. Same thing with homework. A lot of people get into this homework, you know, you do your homework, you get the sticker, you know, and at the end of the week, you know, you get this. It starts to become work. It's no longer curiosity based. It's no longer, I'm interested in my homework and doing it because I want a reward at the end of the week, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, it's really, it's quite powerful when you can get away from actually dampening down people's natural ability to want to cooperate by doing that. So, I think I may have lost your question there somewhere.
No, this is all quite relevant. And I think before you started to say something about the brain and how, you know, maybe how different reward centers, this might relate to the brain. And I know you're interested in the interpersonal biology of the approach that you're describing. So tell us about that. Let's go inside the skull a little bit here.
Okay. Yeah. Great. And in fact, I mean, it's really important to recognize that in a way that it's much more than just the skull. It's our entire nervous system. Okay.
Sure.
And our nervous system has often been somehow relegated to the skull.
Yes, right.
But it doesn't end there. So what's important to understand is our relational interaction with one another will affect our whole nervous system. You interviewed Stephen Porges.
Yes, right.
And so. He was able in his interview there to share with you a little bit about this, his discovery and his theory that he's been developing, which is now, you know, quite an advanced and backed up theory, and that in mammals and then most developed in humans, we have this part of our nervous system called the ventrovagal parasympathetic system, according to his theory. Which engages through the use of our face and our voice and our nonverbal communication when we engage and give the message of safety. So when we give a message of safety, which is a curious, accepting message, which we deliver actually nonverbally with our eyes and our voice and our tone, we engage this nervous system, which is calming. It decreases the kind of arousal, the heart rate. It changes the state. It's what you use if you're going to try and hypnotize someone. Those soft tones, those, you know, there's that part of it, right? It's very powerful.
I seem to recall that oxytocin plays a role in that.
Certainly, yes. Oxytocin, you know, is what also is part of that system, which is quite fascinating. Yes. So in doing this, we have now changed the interaction, right?
Yes. And so that
opens up kind of a different ability to think, okay? Because when we are not calm, we think with our survival brain, right? So then we're orienting to different things, and we can access different parts of our, you know, kind of behavioral repertoire, right? We get defensive, if you know what I mean, right? If somebody, you know, the boss confronts you at work, you know, you get defensive, right? If you're like, where is this thing? You know, and then the whole nonverbal isn't curious at all.
Right. And that defensive system kicks in really fast.
Kicks in, right? And so we lose our ability to be curious very quickly. And then you often, you know, with a teenager, you'll get answers like, I don't know. And the head hangs, you know, and then there's no eye contact. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of almost frozen, perhaps, in front of you if it's confrontational enough, or they start, you know, reacting with anger, right? Which then you're really not cooperating anymore. You're now adversaries. You're not solving a problem. You are, you know, in a confrontation with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's very, very much about our interpersonal neurobiology.
Where does attachment theory fit in with that, or interface with it? Because I think it's all tied together in one big whole.
Absolutely. Attachment theory ties into this directly. Attachment theory explains a number of things. One of the things it explains is the development of our nervous system and our patterns of regulating our nervous system. So right from pre-birth, there's a dance going on between the child and the parents, and that dance involves the nervous system. It involves the development, genetic expression, so epigenetics, which is, you know, a whole fascinating area that's just been kind of coming around in the past, you know, couple decades here. And then after birth, this interaction broadens to include other senses, sound, hearing, which starts before birth, but after birth, that becomes different, and then visual and alerting to the face, and so obviously an infant can't regulate its own nervous system, you know, it's not able to, but over time it may become able to regulate it, certainly more and more and more independently, but never entirely independently. So none of us will regulate our nervous systems entirely independently at any point in our life, which is why, you know, solitary confinement doesn't tend to be very good for the nervous system. So we always maintain some level of interpersonal regulation, mm-hmm, all the way through. So attachment is basically, how do we orient to somebody else's nervous system? Okay? So children will orient, you know, they'll look at their parent when they, you know, to check something out. Is this safe? They'll look, right? Unless they're autistic, in which case that part of the nervous system is not working the way it works when somebody doesn't have that problem. An autistic child doesn't orient to those cues. They manage it internally or somehow through some rituals. But when things are going the way development goes, ideally, I suppose, or, you know, the way it often does, they will orient one way or another. For certain types of attachment patterns, they're orienting constantly. You know, that's the ambivalent attachment, where they orient and they remain super focused on the parents and or on threats around them, and just kind of stay very clingy to, and sometimes reactive, you know, trying to control their parents somehow by either caregiving them or controlling them through, you know, sort of demands or some kind of coercion. There's all kinds of different patterns that can happen. Or the avoidance, which does not orient and tends to orient away from the parent when they get stressed, they tend to not reach out. They tend to be quite very early trying to be more independent, although they're still stressed. You know, these kids may look not stressed sometimes, but underneath we call them, you know, it's like a duck, you know, sitting on the water. Their feet underneath are going very quickly, but on the surface they look very calm.
I love that metaphor.
Yeah. So those are different patterns of attachment. And so, I mean, in my last post there that we talked a little bit about, I talked about how, you know, as young people, you know, in our culture, we've kind of had some strange patterns with how things have changed in our, you know, in our Western, what do they call it? Weird Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and developed world, you know, the weird culture, where most of our science is based. Most of our science subjects come from this culture. So we don't often compare outside of it. So in our culture, we really have this strange pattern that in adolescents are spending their time in a very much their own age group categories. We send them off to school. They spend the whole day there. After school, they hang out together. And sometimes they hardly come home at all, you know? And that, we've kind of come to look at that as kind of normal. But is it? And what does that do to this attachment that's still important?
Yes.
I think we can kind of start to understand some of the very big problems that we run into. But, I mean, you know, if you know how many parents who kind of are thinking about their kids entering teenage years, you don't tend to get a lot of, oh, this is going to be so easy, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, what you're suggesting is that if all the mirroring that you get is from other underdeveloped, undeveloped nervous systems, then right. It's not really that supportive of your own development and growth.
Right. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've you've come across some of the studies on primates, you know, monkeys or different primates, where they experiment with having them being raised in groups with adults and having them being raised in groups with only other immature.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
It's called peer raised. You know, the classic studies have looked at what happens if you separate monkeys from their parents, right? And then they're just in the cage by themselves and they cling on to that carrot cloth thing, right?
Right.
Harlow's monkeys, right?
Yes.
And that doesn't go well. So then the next question was, well, what if they just, we put them in a group with a whole bunch of other immature monkeys and they cling on to each other. They become each other's carry cloth thing. But I mean, it's better than a carry cloth, monkey on the wire mesh on the wire backdrop or whatever. Right. But it's still not the same as having mature others.
That really suggests to me, I'm immediately getting a picture of a gaggle of girls at the mall.
Exactly, yeah. And now with social media, where they can be in constant contact with each other, all kind of 24/7, as they say, it can become a very desperate clinging through difficult times. And a lot of things get quite out of regulation there. If you hear of groups of, you know, young people who are all struggling and who all turn to one another to kind of soothe themselves. So now they're no longer attaching to adult caregivers. They're attaching to each other. Call them in the middle of the night. I'm having a bad time. I just cut myself. And they try and support each other desperately, just panicking, you know. It can become, when you explore the world of these young people, a very desperate kind of situation.
Yeah, wow. That really is a different way of looking at it. I mean, I hadn't thought of, you know, in terms of the primate behavior that you described and sort of seeing how that might map on to a lot of what's going on with social media and so on. And I think a lot of those, you know, there's this term emo.
Yes.
Are you familiar with
that? Very familiar with it, yes.
Maybe not everybody's familiar with it. Tell us your version of what emo refers to.
Well, it refers to a number of things. It's a cultural term, and it basically refers to a sort of a subgroup of young people. You know, back in my day, growing up, there was, you know, the punks and the mods and the preps and the jocks. Well, the emos kind of are their own little, you know, subgroup. And in this group, they have a certain hairstyle and they have a certain fashion sense, and they listen to certain kinds of music. But they also, strangely, have this behavior of self-harm that can kind of came on somewhere along the way as being part of this almost fashion sense. They may have a bandana around their wrist where they've cut themselves very often. So I remember, you know, this sort of came on sometime in the early noughts or the early 2000 years there. And I was thinking, wow, like now mental health problems are almost seeming to come off as like cultural fashion things. It's very strange mixture of a social phenomenon, if you want. So basically, I mean, the idea emo comes from emotional,
yeah,
right? And somehow the word, the music was emotional, referring to, you know, sensitive, talking about how I'm feeling. It got a lot of, backlash from, you know, it became almost a kind of an insult that kids would use with one another.
Yes,
because of the vulnerability of it, right? You're talking about how you're feeling. We don't talk about how we're feeling. That's, you know, you get, you know, one group of kids beating up on another group of kids, as almost always happened. But, you know, in this way, you could see how, it would get a real nerve. That's my understanding of that.
Yeah, that's good. I actually learned quite a bit because I could not have said all that. Now, I know that you're in the last year of training in Dr. Peter Levine's somatic experiencing approach to trauma. What's the role of trauma in the background of the teens that you work with? I mean, is that kind of what's motivating you to do that training?
Not entirely. I'm not in my last year. I'm in a condensed training of it. So I'm still doing my really the first. If you think of it as three sections, I'm still my first section. It's a kind of condensed one. So I should be able to get things wrapped up by the beginning of 2015. I went to the Interpersonal Neurobiology Conference down in LA last year. I'd read some of Peter Levine's work before, and had been introduced to it to some colleagues. It really is quite a different paradigm. So I wasn't, you know, I was sort of like, huh, that's interesting, but wow, is that ever different? When I saw Peter Levine do his work up at the front there and then show his videos, I was just really captivated. I was just so curious. It really fit in, you know, a lot with what I've been talking to you about, and it really made a lot of sense to me. So I decided to go and pursue this training just to really get a sense of how this might sort of add a deeper level of understanding. And really, I mean, it's quite profound. Certainly his work is kind of came up in the idea of how the nervous system responds to trauma.
Yes.
But really, I don't know that it needs to kind of end there. I really think, again, this whole attachment piece works with all of that nervous system as well. As well as, you know, other things which are not trauma, like grief and loss, you know, all those same layers of the nervous system are involved in that kind of emotional adjustment. And whereas a loss is not a trauma, it's natural, and sometimes, right, loss is part of life. It's not considered like a car accident, and yet it can kind of really impact the nervous system in profound ways when it doesn't go well. And it can remain kind of frozen in the nervous system, much like trauma can, especially when we're talking about, you know, abandonment type of loss, right? We often don't think of abandonment as a trauma. It's not a, you know, assault or a car accident. But it is quite very similar, because survival hinges on us not being abandoned.
Sure.
So in many ways, I don't know that we can really differentiate these things. I mean, there is some differences. I think they're different parts of the nervous system that get lit up there, but they kind of engage the very same sympathetic, parasympathetic systems that trauma does. So it's really, it's very fascinating. And I'm learning a great deal from just, going through the training. It's really been something remarkable.
Yeah. I'm not surprised from what I've heard. And when I think about my own experiences with, being on locked wards and so on. When you look into the backgrounds of the people that are there, you find, you know, if not out and out trauma, very difficult circumstances in past lives. It's
absolutely, absolutely, and then very often there is trauma. I mean, very often.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely, you know, in the work that I do, very much alive in terms of what's going on.
You know, I tried to get Dr. Peter Levine to interview him, and I'm going to keep trying. I've tried to tunnel in through different contacts, but so far with no luck. What is it that parents need to understand about communicating with and relating to their teens, to troubled teens in particular, I guess?
Well, I think it's pretty important to just understand that that what we expect of teens in terms of managing their world is we actually expect quite a lot of them. I think there's this kind of almost mythology that kids these days have it incredibly easy, you know, that it's a rich society, right? You know, we live in a rich society. We have all these things that most of us never had, or many of us, certainly my parents never had these things. That's why, you know, the kids are spoiled, that they're they're just not grateful and so on. And what we lose, and I mean, often they aren't, but grateful, that is. But what we lose sight of is the incredible challenges that they face right from early on in their lives.
Oh, yes.
That probably, we never did, or some of us might not have, which is that often they're growing up in communities that are really kind of thrown together because there's so much mobility nowadays. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're growing up without a context of known, predictable others.
Mm-hmm.
They go to school. We don't know who they're interacting with. We don't know their teachers. We don't know the peers. We're basically putting them in a group of strangers, which our nervous systems, I do not think, are adapted to. You know, our primate ancestors did not grow up surrounded by strangers. And if you look at primates in general, if you put them around strangers, they tend to kill each other. So it's quite
good.
Yep,
point.
Well, they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they will, you can't put a bunch of gorillas or chimpanzees or most other primates in a group of strangers without them, you know, basically fighting to death.
I'm getting scared just hearing you describe this. I think I'm being re-traumatized with going to kindergarten or something.
You know, it's true, right? I mean, it's a very stressful thing we're doing, and we don't really appreciate that. That's why there's so much separation anxiety, you know, with kids going to kindergarten and they cling onto their mom's legs. And, you know, I mean, and very often I'm working with kids where that's where it started, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
They got restrained by a teacher to hold them there, and then, oh, don't worry, they'll calm down eventually. Just leave. You know, they're being held by some stranger, right? It's very stressful on the nervous system. So, I mean, you know, by teenage years, you know, our kids will have kind of numbed themselves out to that, sort of. But then they enter a different stage where now they have to seek their identity amongst these others that are surrounding them, some of whom will have some safety with if they're lucky, but many of whom they don't. And then it becomes a very intense contest for who fits in. And that is, you know, just, and their nervous systems at teenagers are changing to make that of paramount importance. They're now really being driven by a new set of instructions that say you have to get out into the world now. It's time for you to disconnect. Sort of, a little bit, you know, that's natural. Yeah. Our attachment to our parents starts to become a little less important, but then that kind of regulation within the new environment becomes so much more important. So the really heightened sense of importance of all these other people around you and finding your safety there. And if you don't find it, it can become quite stressful. And so kids shut down and, you know, the rates of depression, of course, start to go up once you enter as do almost every other kind of mental health problem in the teenage years, start to go up. Drug use, of course, and disordered eating patterns and, depression and then also even more severe problems like, you know, psychosis and those schizophrenia and such. So, for your average parent, many times your kids are kind of navigating this more or less successfully, if you're lucky. But they might not be, and they might start to struggle, and they might start to come home really moody. They might start to disengage from you in a way that doesn't seem okay. Like, you know, but a lot of people are like, oh, they're teenagers. You know, they're just moodies. No big deal. You know, they'll grow out of it. But, you know, you want to pay a little attention to it, right? And really see if you can kind of, I mean, here's one thing that we can fall into as a society. One thing we can fall into is to think, oh my God, I really hope my kid fits in. And I really want to, you know, make sure they understand how important that is. And I'm going to like really, you know, tell them, you know, go make some friends and, you know, have you asked those guys to be friends? And are you, you know, want to buy some new clothes maybe, make yourself, you know, fit in. Don't embarrass yourself. We start to give these messages that make this even more important than it already is. And that's something we could do a lot better, I think, you know, generally to say, you know what, let's not make them even more worried about fitting in. Let's give them some space to, maybe it doesn't have to be that important. Let's give them a secure place here where they can be safe with us and we don't look at them with disappointment if they don't have, you know, all these cool friends or if they're acting a bit geeky or a bit nerdy or whatever this is that we call kids who don't, you know, meet the norm, right?
Yes.
Yeah, maybe it's okay for them to be, you know, chess club or, you know, that kind of thing. And we don't have to, you know, kind of give them that kind of, oh God, you know, he's going to get rejected. And, you know, that's our insecurity that gets lit up when we see our kids, you know, maybe not throwing themselves into the peer world. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
Well, it's certainly a big topic, you know, when I ask what do parents need to know about communicating with their troubled teens. So that's a subject for certainly more than one book. So similarly, let me ask you for a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what psychotherapists, maybe psychotherapists who are not specifically trained in working with teens, what is it that psychotherapists need to understand about communicating with and relating to troubled teens? And certainly everything that you've just outlined about the social and inner world of the teen is very relevant here. But what is it that the average psychotherapist might not be aware of or might miss?
Good. Yeah, that's a really great question. Well, I think really the number one thing that I think we can all do better, you know, many of us maybe, you know, what we haven't paid as much attention to as maybe is important is nurturing the relationship between the teen and his parents. I think, unfortunately, as a discipline, we've often started to get, oh, you know, these kids are messed up. It's because their parents are messed up. And, you know, we got to sort of, you almost start feeling this adversarial kind of thing to protect these kids from their parents. Because, you know, very often, of course, the troubled teens, their parents have been less than perfect. You know, no big surprise, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and we start to see this sort of this negative energy starts to, yeah, you know, God, your mom, you know, she's like such a problem. Your dad, you know, oh my God, he's abusive. And we forget that. Well, and I mean, if they really are abusive, that is a very serious problem. But very often it seems like they're abusive. Really, it's just, they're not coping well, right? But there's still a positive side. You know, maybe they yell or maybe, you know, occasionally there's even physical confrontations. And we can get so caught up in that we forget, you know, hey, is there maybe any value here in what's the good side of this family? You know, how what's their resilience? How do they work together? How are they committed to each other? How have they, you know, really think creatively about that? So you want to find that balance. You know, you don't want to accept abuse. That's not okay. But you want to not immediately start to, because we can easily alienate kids from their own families by just our, how we think about it. And very often kids already come to us kind of alienated from their families. And sometimes by accident, we kind of reinforce that when it's not necessary. And when there aren't any good replacements for families, because therapists cannot be parents, we can see them a certain amount of time, and we can develop a bit of an attachment relationship with them. But we're lousy attachment figures. We just do not have the presence availability they're not available the kind of 24/7 that a real attachment figure needs to be. So we want to help be the kind of like conduit to reattaching where attachment can happen, you know, and that usually is the parents with most teens that, you know, unless there's something so severe going on that that can't happen, in which case then we have to move that somewhere else. I think that's really important. And when I do this all the time now, like somewhere along the line that clicked in for me and it happened. I remember with one case where all of a sudden I went, oh my God, kind of like, what have we done? Now I'll tell you, if we have enough time to tell this little story.
Oh yeah. And I want to make sure I understand what the it is that you're referring to.
Yeah.
Becoming sort of over-identified as the super therapist, super parent or something?
So what I'm talking about here is where we've accidentally, as a system, alienated a young person from their family by our intervention. Because it does happen actually way more often than we probably realize. And so in the case I'm thinking of, it was a young girl with anorexia. She ended up in the hospital and, with very bad anorexia. And in the literature on anorexia, the old style literature, there was this kind of idea that they had to separate the kid from their parents, that the parents were somehow the problem, and that if we separated them from their parents, the problem would get better.
Hmm.
Now, this is completely, that's the way it, and until very recently, that would keep happening. And it's only been, I think in the past maybe few decades or so, or I don't know, have you ever heard the Maudsley method for helping young people with anorexia where they engage the family and the family takes over the feeding? That's kind of new. I mean, at least when I was training, that was fairly new. It was just now, at this point, it's a pretty accepted practice in helping young girls with anorexia, that we don't remove them from their families. We actually support the families in helping the young person recover from anorexia. Okay. So we see the family as a resource to be drawn on rather than the problem.
Uh-huh.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And wow, the outcomes are so much better.
Yeah, right? There's unfortunate history in psychotherapy and psychiatry of blaming somebody, you know, blaming the mother, blaming the parents, et cetera, blaming the spouse. Blaming the person who's not in the room.
Exactly. So with teens, this becomes so easy to do because very often the teen is blaming their parents. So then we can easily collude with that. Or, you know, we might sort of say, you know, the teen will tell us a few stories about their family and we're like, oh my God, you know,
right.
It's horrible, right? But we don't really get, you know, the context, the full context. And we need to build a relationship with the parents. Very often parents actually pick this up and they start to be like not so happy about what's going on with their kid. You know, we don't communicate often very well with their parents if we're not careful about it.
Yes. Well, as we begin to wind down here, I know that you have some, I believe, maybe strong opinions, feelings about the current situation in psychiatry. Tell us about that.
Oh, okay. I think it's a mixed thing. I mean, I think it's, In many ways, there's a lot of exciting opportunities that are coming up with neuroscience and how it can inform our interventions. But we're also at a time of change. You know, I mean, I really, I think, you know, I mean, you've a number of your interviews have all kind of, you know, talked about this. So I think we're seeing a kind of, possibly it's like a state of flux, you know, where we've, I think there was a lot of optimism that certain approaches were going to bring, you know, really big advances, you know, in psychopharmacology, you know, with the DSM, you know, and in fact, I mean, a lot of positive things, you know, we learned a lot of things, like we learned many things, but we've also come to, I think, a stage where we're like, but it's not, we haven't found the keys to the kingdom here. These don't, you know, the DSM categories don't map on to what we thought they might. They're actually quite muddy. They're actually quite, you know, not quite as crystal as we would have initially maybe thought they were going to be as entities. And our medications, you know, they work, but they sometimes, and sometimes they actually don't, and sometimes they work so much less than we kind of thought they would, they thought they were. You know, with some of the new information that's come out on the fact how antidepressants actually work, as compared to how we sometimes, you know, thought as far as the results, you know, from a mild to moderate depression, the evidence is pretty weak. In fact, it's actually getting stronger that it doesn't do much compared to placebo.
It's shocking to me to learn as a result of these interviews that I've been doing and the reading that I've been doing that none of the psychotropic medications were developed from an understanding of the brain, but rather were some medication that was used for some other condition, and it was kind of accidentally discovered that, you know, it could help with this or that psychological.
Yeah, so there's a disillusionment, I think. I think there's a little bit of a disillusionment happening right now, which is, you know, so that's an interesting stage. I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I think there's new opportunities, but we're kind of in between stages. Wasn't it one of your recent interviews that talked about that stage in between where something's kind of withering, but nothing has yet taken its place entirely?
Yes.
A couple of interviews ago. So that's kind of the stage in which we're at. But I think there's a lot of promise. But I think we do have to do some rethinking, I think, about how we're understanding our diagnostic categories. You know, how we're approaching. And I really think, you know, again, starting to look, I think we've been very individualistic about, you know, the individual. I think that's a cultural thing that we kind of glorified the individual, and we somehow have this idea that everything resides inside the individual, but it's not that way. And our neurobiology is very interpersonal. So we can't really, you know, carve people off and try and, you know, I mean, as therapists, we sometimes lose sight of that we need to facilitate the interpersonal world of this young person or individual, not replace it. And we have, you know, keep in mind at all times, right? Those are some different trends, I think, as to where I'm seeing kind of things now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, great. You know, that's probably a good place for us to wrap it up. With that, then, I'll say, Dr. Michael O'Connor, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio, and it's been good to get to know you a little better here.
It's been a great pleasure for me, David.
As you heard, I really resonated with what Dr. Michael O'Connor had to say in this interview. In particular, the picture he painted of the difficulties adolescents in Western societies have in transitioning from childhood to adulthood was particularly vivid for me. Also, I got a much fuller understanding of what is implied by the term emo, which is often encountered online, especially on YouTube. In addition, Dr. O'Connor sent me a follow-up email, which I'd like to share with you. He writes, and I quote, "One last thought about the emo movement when I refer to self-harm. It's important to understand that self-harm, cutting oneself, triggers the endogenous internal endorphin system and is an effort by the cutter to regulate the nervous system. The burst of endogenous chemicals replace the soothing brain chemicals that come from safe interpersonal relationships. In this way, self-harm can become an addiction as powerful as any other addiction and serving the same purpose. This is a situation between parents and youth, when a parent discovers a youth has cut themselves, that can become very reactive. Finding ways to establish safe relationships is the goal. Then the cutting is no longer necessary or craved by the youth." Close quote. So I appreciate that clarification or addition, follow-up. And hot off the press, I just got another email from Dr. O'Connor, which reads as follows. I was thinking, I didn't reference the authors of the theory I was referring to in our interview during our discussion on peer attachment in youth. Please credit Dr. Gordon Neufeld, Ph.D., and Dr. Gaber Mate, M.D. This theory is articulated in their joint work, Hold On to Your Kids, which I highly recommend. I referenced them in my blog post, but realized I neglected to in our interview. And again, that's from Dr. Michael O'Connor. You'll also recall that toward the end of the conversation, I asked Dr. O'Connor for his views on the current state of psychiatry. I think his views are supported in an article I recently was reading from the September 16, 2013 issue of The New Yorker. Let me read one paragraph from page 36. I quote, Benjamin Sadduck, a professor at NYU and the author of a best-selling psychiatry textbook, says that many psychiatrists now treat patients with the understanding that, quotes, pharmacotherapy combined with psychotherapy gives better results than either one alone, close quote. Nancy Andreessen, the psychiatrist who once heralded the biological revolution, feels that the revolution went too far. Quotes, you can't treat a person as a purely biological creature, close quote, she says. Antipsychotic drugs are blunt instruments and are often administered on a trial and error basis. Prolonged exposure at high doses can cause brain damage. When you have a therapeutic relationship, you can manage the dosage better, Andreessen says. You can talk to the patient about their side effects. Compliance goes up. The patient gets better more quickly. And that's the end of the quote in The New Yorker. And I think it really supports some of the things that Dr. O'Connor was saying. I'm so pleased to have Dr. Michael O'Connor as a regular listener. He's pointed me to some good resources and interview guests, and I'm especially pleased to have had this opportunity to have him on as a guest.
I support Shrink Wrap Radio, for Dr. Dave has his pulse on the emerging contemporary rising stars, endeavoring to provide soul food for listeners seeking nourishment. His recent interview with Dr. Emerson was the pivotal interview, for I have waited 65 years for the reality of trauma-bonded babies, the implications for development, and the due care and attention these special infant children, whom I call sensitives, of which I'm one, so deserve. As a recent contributor, I am listening deeply to the contributions you bring us all.
Thank you, Dr. Linda A.K. Thompson. Your support and encouragement of others to become contributors means a great deal to me. Well, as a podcaster, I try to keep on the cutting edge of technology. I see it as sort of a responsibility. So I did upgrade to the new iPhone 5S with iOS 7, and I'm happy to report I'm loving both. So if any of you are on the fence about these new technologies, I encourage you to jump on board. Speaking of such things, if you're new to the show, you might not be aware that we have an app for both iOS and Android devices. Just click on the Apps tab on our site for full details. Also, I hope you'll become a subscriber in iTunes, which helps me to keep track of the level of interest out there. And if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not know that if you're a professional in need of continuing education units, we have about 99 APA-approved units that you can earn for listening to these interviews and passing a brief true-false quiz on the material, all for less than $10 a unit. And I'm happy to announce we do have a new transcript on the site. It's a transcript for number 368, Psychoanalytic and Jungian Perspectives on Couples at the Crossroads, with Dr. Daniela Roher and Dr. Susan Schwartz. So thank you, champion transcriber Gloria Ullman, for your work on this one.
Hi, this is Jonathan Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thanks, my good son, Jonathan, whose remarkable story I'm thinking of making the centerpiece on a future podcast. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Philip Brooks, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I am Philip Brooks, psychotherapist of nearly 40 years, core faculty member of the Integral Counseling Psychology Program at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco for 13 years, and former director of the Psychosynthesis Training Program for 17 years. Wow. I mostly listen to Shrink Wrap Radio in the middle of the night when I can't sleep. It's not a particularly good sleep management tool. While some podcasts help me drift off to sleep, this show more often takes me in the opposite direction. I'm glad to hear it. Many guests have profound messages for me. Most recently, I was up for hours applying Dr. Gabor Mate's powerful insights on pain, truth, love, and healing to my life. I've been blown away by the brilliance of people like Ian McGilchrist speaking on the brain's hemispheres, stimulated, energized, and drawn to purchase their books by locals Bruce Ecker and Rick Hansen. I've been taken by surprise by the power of people unknown to me, like the California Institute of Integral Studies' own Nick Walker, and I'm currently using Holosync as an adjunct to my meditation practice as a direct result of this program. I feel blessed to be the recipient of the insights and wisdom of these, quotes, nighttime teachers, close quote, from the healing professions who generously offer the fruits of their years of research and reflection in an accessible hour-long package. Behind all this is our own Bodhisattva, Dr. Dave, doing the grunt work of production, website management, transcript processing, guest solicitation, interview editing, along with the reading and research, and who knows what else required to offer a knowledgeable exchange. What a great service. And he says in parentheses, I don't think you're getting rich off our contributions. He goes on to say, I'll close with my disclosure that I listened to dozens, if not hundreds, of episodes before I translated my nighttime intention to go to the website and hit the green button, or in my case, to write a check. While I'm glad I did, I know really it's not enough, especially if I'm to compare what I get from this week after week compared to the other ways I spend my money. At the risk of sounding insincere with excessive praise, 10,000 thank yous for your contribution to my life and by extension to my clients, students, family, and friends. Warmly, Philip. And he puts in a P.S., putting another plug in for Nancy McWilliams, who seems interested in being on the show. She's a solid academic practitioner who presents her psychodynamic approach in a way that is warm, open, insightful, and a big favorite of students at CIIS. Well, Philip, thank you for your effusive praise. I've never been called a bodhisattva before, but it's clear that you really understand the amount of work and preparation that does go into the preparation of these podcasts. And I'm glad that to some extent they've been a sleep tool for you, but even more glad to the extent that it's disrupted that it's disrupted your sleep. I took a psychosynthesis workshop through Esalen many years ago with the Varjus, and I'm wondering if you know the Varjus. I think they were among the first people to help popularize psychosynthesis in this country. And thank you for the reminder about Nancy McWilliams. I'm trying to remember now if I've scheduled her or not. It seems to me that this memory jog did cause me to reach out to her. I'll have to double check on that. If I didn't, I will do so. Okay, so now I have to remember that commitment. Okay, the next one comes from Ralph in Germany, who writes, Dear David, I was very impressed with Mark Winborn, John Fredrickson, and I think that Bruce Ecker has solved the riddle of Freud. Many writers, such as Pearl, Skinner, Beck, and Soloway, have announced the death of Freudianism, but the old doctor seems to live on. Just what is in Freud that touches his readers so profoundly? I guess it's just what is it in Freud that touches his readers so profoundly? Louis Breger said, after researching Freud, that he seemed only hit and miss at actually helping his patients. Jung was better at understanding the vast complexity of the unconscious mind. Your guest, John Fredrickson, certainly understands defense mechanisms better than Freud did. If you can get past Freud's intense jealousy, the Oedipal complex, and his sexual identity problems and his mother complex, just what did the man write that is so universal? I truly believe that Bruce Ecker has come across the same human issues. Freud wrote about connecting, quotes, ideational content with unconscious, repressed affect, close quote. I think that Ecker's, quote, implicit emotional learning, close quote, and his, quote, memory reconsolidation, close quote, are describing the same problem. Joseph Wolpe's reciprocal inhibition is like Ecker's juxtaposition of contradictory learning. Wolpe reads Freud when he was a young man. Wolpe read Freud when he was a young man. In the modern technology of human behavior, this is what gets left behind. Ecker understands that the denial of symptoms, and he puts in parentheses CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, does not work for patients with anxiety disorders. The cognitive fighting with unwanted thoughts is like Ian McGilchrist's description of mental illness as, quote, a hole in the right brain and the left brain is overloaded, close quote. Like Pearls wrote, bottom dog always wins over the top dog. Ecker understands, like Freud did, that we have to get to the bottom of the symptom and understand that first. Many thanks for your show, and it's signed Ralph. Well, Ralph, I'm certainly impressed by your knowledge of the literature. You're clearly widely read in psychology and very thoughtful. You actually puzzle out the contradictions and the history and try to make some sense of it. And you should probably be teaching a class. Next, we hear from listener John, who writes, hi, Dave. I listened to your talk with Bob Moss, and I really enjoyed it. This is a fascinating development. I first came across Skinner and his black box in my first year of psychology many years ago, and now I can put something inside the box that makes sense to me. Perhaps you can get Bob back to expand on his concepts. I might turn out to become a convert to biobehaviorism. And he puts in a smiley face. I responded to that note, and I said I had the impression that maybe he was a newcomer to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I suggested a bunch of interviews that I thought he would be particularly interested in. And he wrote back, he said, I am indeed a newcomer. I will listen to the interviews you've suggested. In a previous life, I was a fundraiser, and I was wondering how you finance your operation. Not that I'm offering to fundraise, but just curious. Too bad. I wish he would have offered to fundraise. He says, but having said that, the link between fundraising and psychotherapy is actually, in my opinion, quite strong. At the end of the day, the donor gives the money to the asker or fundraiser for a worthy cause, worthy in the eyes of the donor, and does so within a relationship that resembles that of a therapeutic relationship / alliance. Have you ever interviewed anybody on this topic? Not that I'm offering to be interviewed. I wonder whether anyone at Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy has any ideas on this matter. Fundraising, I found, is a bit like motivational interviewing, or so it seemed to me. I look forward to listening to your interviews from now on. Thanks for making the information available in this fashion. Cheers, John. Well, John, that certainly opened up a whole new kettle of fish. I've never reflected on similarities between fundraising and psychotherapy. I certainly didn't know anything about the Indiana University Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And as I wrote to you, I don't do any serious fundraising other than my appeals for listener donations, and also get a little bit of money for posting interviewees' books in the right-hand sidebar on our site. So everybody listening, take that as a hint to patronize those people who do pay something to advertise their books. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area after each interview. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Michael O'Connor, for sharing his expertise and insights into the world of teens. On the next episode, I'll be speaking once again with Jungian analyst Monica Wickman. She's a favorite on the show, and we'll be discussing her collaboration with Stan Grof and his holotropic breathwork workshops, and any other topics that crop up in the course of that conversation, because she's always such a font of energy and information. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.